Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comic Extension. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Chris Casso.
Hello.
Cole Hornaday.
Hey there.
And Nicole Lamb.
Hi.
Hello, friends.
Hi.
How is everybody?
It's okay. We've been here for a little bit.
Yeah, so we've been here.
You get the entertaining podcast.
That's right. It's the podcast now. Yeah. Every 3 weeks, you're welcome.
All right. Well, perhaps this seems fun and to us now, but if we listen to this episode 10, 20 years from now, maybe it won't be so fun. Maybe it will have aged poorly. So I want to ask you, friends, what comics from days gone by have aged poorly when read today?
Just about everything I read in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, Chris had printed an interview with Frank Miller.
Oh, yeah.
And that I reposted onto the Facebook, Panel Jumper Facebook page. But I also found another piece, an opinion piece someone had written a couple of years ago about how Dark Knight has not aged, nor is it really relevant. And actually, back in the day, people were overlooking all the fascistic aspects of how Batman is depicted. And I have to agree with all of that. It seems like every other week, someone I know on Facebook is asking for recommendations.
Right.
I'm teaching a class, or I've got to write a book, or I've got to write a paper, and inevitably I just kind of hold my breath and wait for that one person who is my age, who has not branched out in their reading, who recommends Watchmen and Dark Knight, and I just like want to turn off the thread, because I'm tired of that as a recommendation, because I don't really think that people are looking at how poorly that material has aged, how it represented a period of time, and that we all as readers in a culture need to move on. But I don't think a lot of people quite grasp why that's significant. And that's the big one for me. I will talk about those books a lot, but I also totally embrace the fact that I've grown up considerably since I thought those books were such a big freaking deal.
Mm-hmm. Nope. That is, it's one of those things I just hear those as kind of the automatic recommendations too often.
They're so the defaults, and it's annoying.
Let's expand a little bit more.
I agree with you.
For me personally, it's a lot of the X-Men from the 90s. I really loved Age of Apocalypse when it happened, because it actually was an interesting gimmick, canceling your entire line and starting over with new titles that took place in an alternate reality. Mm-hmm. And so there's still elements of that are really good, but every time I take a look, we have the trade paperbacks here, and I'm like, maybe I should reread this, and I open one up and I see some of that art. I'm like, nope, goodbye, see you later.
What about that art bugs you now?
Well, there's like 50 artists in that thing, so...
But is it... For me, it's the Rob Liefeld influence that I just think, and the McFarlane influence. It's not the work of those artists. It's the people aping those styles that I think is really irritating.
There's a little less overall in that period, but there's guys like Dan Fraga, I think, were in there, and Roger Cruz, and they still have some of that heavy influence. You get a lot of Joe Madeira, which was actually great at the time, but it's still, there's a lot of really rushed, overwrought is a good way to describe some of that stuff. And I don't know, it's the scripting's just painful on a lot of it. Bob Harris and a bunch of other guys at the time. So like the X-Men relaunch that Claremont did with Jim Lee, it's just like that dialogue. Actually, even the old Chris Claremont X-Men, having to sit through his dialogue kills me so much.
Yep.
And so, yeah, most of the Extreme 90s never holds up.
Extreme 90s? Is that like the golden age?
The dark age.
It's the dark age, yeah. It's when we talk about Young Blood and Blood Strike and Blood and all those other
Rip
titles.
Ripclaw.
Wetworks.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's
X-Mutant, Extreme, Excalibur.
Yep. So none of that holds up for me whenever I try to go back and look at it. As an overall, like, what doesn't hold up over long periods of time? I was going to say the majority of Golden Age. there's just sometimes that when I try to sit through a good chunk of Superman Golden Age, I'm like, that's enough. Put it down. Go away.
Yeah.
Miracle Man Golden Age is utterly horrendous to sit through.
Now, is it horrendous because it's just bad writing from, like, a storytelling perspective? Or is it horrendous because it's from the 40s, and so it's very, like...
It's all of that.
Can you look at it in a historical context? Like, you know, this is where... These are where these ideas germinated, and they're trying to... They're trying to figure out how to tell these stories back then.
And I can, and some of them are stronger than others, but I just find myself, if I have to look through an entire volume of Golden Age, my eyes glaze over. And some of it is just the stiffness of some of the art. Some of it also is my problem specifically of, I've seen enough of this stuff that it's all... repetitive now, and the fact that this is the first time for many of it doesn't register, or I don't care. I'm just like, got it, I'm done, moving on. You know, there's so many other things I could read right now. So yeah, I don't want to put that broad of a blanket on the entirety of an entire era, but it's difficult for me to get excited about Golden Age comics.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and there's like a lot of writers like in the 60s and 70s who were really heavy dialoguers, you know, in general, and like lots of heavy narrations and stuff like that. And it's so drastically different from how modern comics are that if you go back a couple periods, it's going to be so different that it could actually be maybe too dry or something like that. Like, I have Captain America, like Jack Kirby's Captain America, but it is hard to read because it's like... Jack Kirby wasn't the best writer.
Nope.
God bless him,
but nope.
And it's really cool to see the art, but it's like hard to sit down and like read that fully. You know, it's just like little bits, and it's like, okay.
I think when you look at a lot of that stuff, you realize how much the art form has come into its own and gravitated toward a sort of a consensus of how we tell these stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, just, you know, looking at the dialogue, heavy, the Louise Simonson, Chris Claremont style of writing, where it's like there's so much text crammed into a frame, it's ridiculous. It's like you were just writing a novella and somebody happened to be drawing pictures for you.
Yeah.
And it gets frustrating. And now we look at how crisp and clean the layouts of panels are, and how I would like to think that there's a more precise relationship between words and images than there were before.
Yeah, a lot of less is more kind of thing.
Yeah, mentality. Yeah. And so I think that we've kind of gotten spoiled by that too, and we forget that there was a lot of germinating of how this type of sequential storytelling was evolving. And for that reason, I'm afraid to go back and reread stuff, particularly from the 90s that I enjoyed. Case in point is... James Robinson's Starman. I adored that series. I don't want to go back and reread it because I know I'm probably going to really dislike it. And I have very, very fond memories of that whole series that he did as being quite genius. And I know it's not going to be genius when I go back and look at it. However, the Game and Sandman stuff from that time period, I think is great. I still think it has a timeless aspect to it. What'd you go dig up?
Stan Lee is one of the talents that I can't stand rereading. Yeah. Nope. And a lot of it has to do, like, so a trade came out called Spider-Man No More, and it collects, let's see, number 39 through 52, plus a bunch of other stuff. And just going on to a quick page here, there's a part like, the lovable lizard, the darling Doc Ock, the ever-loving Electro. And then they get the whole section where the dialogue's like, that's Groot. Cats, and it's just like, I hate all of you.
The ever-loving blue-eyed thing.
Well, there was an element of pop camp that was celebrated back then, which is why the Adam West Batman TV series was so successful, is that it was both a loving wink and also, you know, a send-up. But I think Lee was doing that with his language and his captioning, you know, long before that TV series came about in 1966.
And it fits. And I think when I was younger, I was like, oh, okay, yeah. I just, I get it's obnoxious to me now.
Yeah, yeah. I do.
And it's a little too much for me. And so I have to separate myself from it just a bit, just because, like, okay, that was meant for a time and a place. I got it.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Cole, you had mentioned that Sandman still holds up. I've never read Sandman. Right. Maybe eventually I will, but I did read Doom Patrol in recent times. And that,
the Morrison stuff?
Yeah, all the Morrison stuff. All that older Vertigo, like late 80s, early 90s stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe not all of it, but some of the more important ones seem to still hold up pretty well.
Have you looked at Animal Man?
I haven't. Is that something that you would say holds up?
Yeah, Grant Morrison's Animal Man as well. There was some really unique storytelling. And that's where he was sort of doing his a lot of his experimentation with his storytelling, with self-reflexivity. Mm. And there was a lot of similar qualities between Doom Patrol and Animal Man. I reread some Animal Man within the last couple of years and still enjoyed it. I haven't touched the Doom Patrol, though.
Mm.
So, but I got to tell you, I had to give up on the Gerard Way Doom Patrol. It was such a persistently loving nod to Grant Morrison's stuff. And I'm like, we already did this in the 90s, cats. I can't. So I let it go.
It's less of a nod and more of like he's sitting in his lap kind of situation.
Yeah. And if that's the case, then Mr. Way is not as tremendous a storyteller as he'd like us to believe. And that's really disappointing, but we're not here reviewing the book. So,
Something that's modern that doesn't hold up to it.
Yeah. No, I got
10 days from release still counts as a time. still a range of time. So, yeah.
But stuff that does hold up, like, you know, that just has a timeless aspect to it, or things like, you know, Jeff Smith's Bone.
Yep.
And one of the reasons why Bone is so timeless is that it borrows so much from an earlier era of cartooning and storytelling. Mm-hmm. And that's what struck me about it when the first time I read it. I'm like, I don't know when this is written. I have no idea when this, mm-hmm. if you handed me a book without a copyright notice in it, I would not be able to tell you. It could have been written in 1940,
yeah.
1950, 1990. You know, and that's because he borrows so much from Carl Barks and that era of cartooning, mm-hmm. which I got to applaud him for, because he hasn't captured that kind of magic with his other stories.
Yeah,
you know? He just hasn't.
That's the key one for him.
Yeah.
So this isn't comics, but I'm rewatching the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, like Ben mentioned a podcast ago, and so I just did first Iron Man and Hulk with Edward Norton, and there's so much fan service at the early stages that it doesn't hold up for me, because there's stuff like when Nick Fury first showed up, he's like, "You're part of a larger universe," wink, and you're just like, "Ah!" And I remember when everybody's just like, "Oh, he said the thing," and it's just like, "Ah!" And then like it doesn't match up anymore too, because in the Hulk one, it's like, this doesn't really line up with any of the continuity you guys set forth, but you still have him show up, Tony Stark, and it's just like, I'm putting together a team, wink. And it's just like, well, okay. By the time we get to Avengers, that's not as painful. But yeah, so the early half doesn't quite hold up on those aspects.
I had to force myself to finish Hulk.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm there with you.
It existed, honestly.
It's not terrible, but it's just so bland, and Edward Norton.
It's dull.
It is dull.
I'm kind of anti-Edward Norton.
I am too. Yeah. Yeah.
That's fair. I think that's fair.
Join us on our anti-Edward Norton podcast.
I think I've mentioned this before, but I'm mentioning it again. They did make a game that lined up with the movie, Incredible Hulk video game, and they did get Edward Norton to do the vocals, but he literally was talking like this.
He don't care.
You couldn't have sounded more phoned in. Yeah. Like, it was so monotone.
Mark Ruffalo is an angel from heaven that
he
came
really
to
is,
us.
But never have him at a press release. He will tell all the secrets.
Yes. But so that those don't hold up for me.
Have you ever saw something that's been solicited or saw something in a store where it was maybe like a reboot or a refresh or like Kick-Ass, it's like, we're just doing it again, and you're like, well, I want to read that, but my memory of the original thing is so strong, I don't want that to sell it if that is bad.
I get what you're saying, and I don't think I've ever had that experience, because I force a separation in my mind pretty hardcore most of the time. Yeah.
That question comes from my friends who have seen what movie? It's not Hellraiser. It's anyway, there's a movie and it's really good and people liked it. And then the sequel came out, which retroactively ruined the original movie because it was so bad.
Yeah.
I find that happens a lot in movies and TV shows more than it happens.
I mean, that's the entirety of the New 52 for me.
It
ruined an entire universe. So backtracking, I have trouble giving a crap about any of it.
Yeah.
So, yes, I have felt that experience.
Are you talking Terminator 3?
No.
How about Alien Resurrection?
There's a lot of examples in film, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Any final words on
GoldenEye?
Any final words on comics that have not aged well? Might be Hellblazer. I'm not quite sure.
Hellblazer? I can't really.
I really have to. I think that they're all on a clock because when we go back and look at comics, they are so often byproducts of their time,
right?
And you know, because look how we talk about Jack Kirby, and we talk with reverence about his Fourth World stuff, but you know, when you sit down and actually read that dialogue, it's hard to get through without laughing. And you look at the energy and the dynamic visuals and how it's influenced. But at the same time, there are cringeworthy moments on every other page.
Yeah.
You still love it. But I kind of got to ask, when a kid picked that up off the newsstand in, you know, 1972, they weren't jeering at it or pointing or making fun of the groovy hip lingo. They were committed the way Kirby was committed. So my question is, you know, what is it people reading comics that are printed today going to say 10, 20 years from now?
Yeah, sure. What comics today are not going
because
to
I really well. Feel that the storytelling aspects of comics right now are really up to speed with cinematic storytelling. And sometimes the distinction is between print and digital imagery. And there's... but otherwise, there aren't things ripping you out of the narrative.
What we might want to do is a counter episode where we talk about the word evergreen. Because Dan Didio and Jim Lee disagree with the idea that there will always be certain titles that are evergreen. So they disagree with what you said just a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. And
evergreen meaning that they're always good no matter what time you read them.
Exactly. And I think they mean it that they're always cash cows. But yes, we'll go with yours. So maybe we can talk about like what are evergreens, because you also just said Bone. Bone feels pretty evergreen.
I would say Bone is evergreen.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so it'd be kind of nice for us to make a list of what actually does hold up and is timeless in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. And then come back to that list 20 years later and see if we were right.
Yep.
All right, let's move on to book.
I'm sorry if I'm podcasting with you guys in 20 years. So something's wrong or really right. I don't know.
From our comics bunker underneath the smoldering heap. Anyway, let's move on to book report.
We're all albino vampires by then.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'm already an albino vampire.
Hey, yeah. Yeah, but you're sporting the fuchsia hair, and that's all that matters.
There you go.
All right. Hey, this is our third round of our All Preacher special. All of us read approximately the same amount of Preacher. We don't know because it gets reprinted so often, it's hard to keep track of the titles.
Mm-hmm. We're winging it.
So we just need to do it by weight. Have you read 4 pounds of Preacher? You're good.
Okay, but just a little caveat. We are skipping the Sex Detectives story arc.
Well,
right?
Let's not say that because where I left off was when Jesse and Tulip left Jesse's grandmother's house, like the end of that story arc.
Yeah, and Angel, the Angelville.
That's the start for
family. Yeah.
And where I picked up was my copy, which I just purchased from the store here during Free Comic Book Day, which is now considered book 2,
right. Yes.
But I was looking at it as the first couple of the first story arc would be the third overall story arc in the Preacher canon. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But it begins with Jesse and Tulip in a motel room doing the naughty. And then they go into the whole, like, drugs.
Jesus Day Sade.
Yeah.
So that is the Sex Detectives. So he read it. I read it. You skipped it?
No, I read them all.
You read it? Okay. Right.
I just read them a lot longer ago than,
gotcha,
you know.
Yes.
You guys are hitting these more recently, so, and I remember things about 20 minutes in the future, and that's about it.
Gotcha.
So, Ben, catch us up.
All the pressure.
Catch us up?
Yeah.
Like from the beginning?
No.
Where we...
Jesse and Tulip, they've reconciled because Jesse told Tulip the real reason why he left her in their distant past. She was, in the first couple of volumes of Preacher, she was like angry at him and he was still madly in love with her. And so they reconciled because he finally told her the truth, and she's been then shot and then resurrected by God.
Mm-hmm.
There's God there, Cola is showing me. So they run off. I don't exactly know where they are, like what city they're in. I think it's New York or New York-ish, and they reconnect with...
Cassidy.
Cassidy, yeah. I gotta say, there's a lot more nudity in this book than I expected.
Yeah.
There wasn't that much, I don't think, in the first two.
That's because she was mad. And there wasn't sex parties.
Yeah. You went straight into the full sex parties.
So Jesse, Tulip, and Cassidy all kind of get on the wrong side of this drug dealer and sex detective team and sex party throwing.
Jesus de Sade. I think, yeah. Yep.
I do like, there's a moment where I think something makes a noise that I really like, but somebody take it over from where I am.
So one thing that I took, because I'm just taking away little bits and pieces each time because I read this far too often.
Yes.
But one thing I didn't put together, so there's themes that Garth Ennis will always return to. Religion, war, mm-hmm. A few other things. But one thing that I didn't realize is that he will always, in every major work, come to a sequence where he will horribly punish somebody for child abuse, specifically sexual child abuse. Yeah. He has a very hard stance in there, and it's very good that he pops up at least now in three or four works of his that I've read. Mm. The Punisher one was the harshest one, where basically he basically says he wished he could kill God for allowing it to happen. So he's
he's very blasphemous.
He's very hard about it.
Yes.
That was just an interesting takeaway on this turn. I'm like, oh yeah, he was doing that all the way back then too.
You left out one aspect of his storytelling, and that is grotesque kink.
Yes.
Everybody gets a kink.
Everybody has a kink.
But I mean, like, I was thinking of like The Boys, and there's a whole miniseries of The Boys, Herogasm, where that's all it is superheroes having really grotesque kinky sex.
Orgies. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. On an island.
That's a thing that happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And
really
we kind
of
do that with
the mature
with,
podcast.
Jesus de Sade is that's what that this whole is. That whole section of the story is I said that wrong. Can you like bleep that out?
No, we're keeping that in.
Yes. It's late in the evening.
Yeah. I was taken aback. Like I talked about earlier, I read Letter 44, which the artwork, like the female representation of Albuquerque's women is very like drastic and sexual and just kind of out there. But there was nothing too explicit. All the naughty bits were covered up.
Yeah, but it's weird. Like a girl shows up in Letter 44 and she is very cold and she's wearing a tiny shirt and they're floating.
No,
she's
it
in
doesn't,
space and it's like, whoa, okay, hi.
It doesn't leave much to the imagination, but so then I have to compare that with Preacher, which leaves nothing to the imagination.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just I guess I'm of that age where I'm still kind of shocked that there is, and I'm still green to comics, I'm shocked that there is even swearing and sex in comics.
Yeah. The thing, something worth pointing out is there's not many times stirring Steve Dillon's artwork that you ever feel anything is truly sexually attractive? Or
yeah, no, not in particular.
I mean, no,
it's pretty benign.
It's benign. I mean,
or
a character.
Repellent.
Yeah, a character.
I find most of the sexual situations in this book to be repugnant and repellent. It's like, that's not doing a thing for me. You keep that mannequin head to yourself. Sure. Oh, and that armadillo on the platter. You have a good time with that.
I'm just saying, it's not like reading a '90s, you know, Rob Liefeld thing where you have this objectified female form.
Yes. Yeah, like every girl's butt you. Is always out and up. You
yeah,
know,
you have fairly. Realistic forms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think Jesse and Tulip, their scenes are pretty, I want to say romantic, even though they're like still gratuitous.
Yeah.
But they're not like exploitative, you know?
Yes,
they're part
that's
of it.
The word.
And that's
yeah.
and that's the difference. Mm-hmm.
Aside from the like the very first scene, the parts where Tulip is naked is not when they're actually having sex. It's like afterwards.
Yeah,
like chilling.
Yeah, just chilling. Yeah, yeah is yeah, where yeah. you would get like, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, are you referring to the moments of afterglow, Ben?
There's also, like I said before when we were talking about Preacher, Steve Dillon loves shooting people in the face.
Yep.
And Cassidy even punches the dude straight in the mouth and gets his hand stuck.
Yep.
In there. And again, I'm like, what's going on? On there, Cassidy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and then he's like stuck, and he's like, "Oh, bollocks!"
That, like our yeah. space sort of look, you know, like the yeah. pucker, you know, the interior.
Yeah, there's
pucker.
A lot of puckering. Yeah. yeah. This does have more hair star development.
Yeah, a lot more.
I do like that. I love Featherstone and the guy, the poor guy who has to count all the sand.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. Why can't I remember his name? I just read
I remember, yes, him. I remember Featherstone because he's always yelling his name like Featherstone
yeah.
whenever she swears.
Right.
And then you have the Masada sequence, which is, I really love because you got some great, Saint of Killer stuff going on there. Mm-hmm. And it did really forward the plot overall.
Mm-hmm. It did,
I thought.
Yeah.
So. Hoover. Featherstone and Hoover.
There you go.
Yeah. And he wasn't, I mean, in Hoover, and they do this sequence where in the TV series where Hoover misunderstands Hair Star's instruction and hires the rough guys to the rough trade prostitutes to come and give him some male dominant love.
Mm.
Yeah. they do that in a TV series. If I remember correctly, in the comic, it's just one more aspect of Hair Star's sexuality, whereas in the TV series, that homosexuality was threatening to him. Or maybe it's the other way around. But
it's threatening to him here because he gets in a really bad situation he didn't want to be in. But then it turns out to be a new opening for him in his sexuality. Yeah.
But he still doesn't want to acknowledge it in a healthy way.
Yes, yeah, very true, very true.
That is something that I think was one of those aspects of Preacher. One of the few things, in to its credit, which I think did not age very well, which is that being forcefully raped by another man would change him to be gay, because that is the
that's homophobia.
That's homophobia. That goes against the conversation we have these days with sexual identity.
There is a moment in there where he says that, and Featherstone's like, "It's not how it works, sir." So there's something
there
in
is that moment. Yeah,
there's something in the narrative that understands that, but it does move forward with the fact that he's still kind of messed up with it.
Yeah.
The way that I take it with him is he likes sordid situations. So something that was maybe traumatic is now somehow cathartic. He's like turned it into something that is helped to release his tension somehow.
Yeah.
Because he's got this strange...
Gets off on pain.
He's got incredible mindset. Sexual appetites.
Yeah. So it's kind of how I spin it, you know? Because there is still a lot of like... masculine machismo things, like with Jesse and Cassidy always being kind of bro-y and stuff like that, that I notice a little bit more. But it still holds up okay for me because there's still vulnerability with the characters. There's still a dynamic aspect to everybody's character. Mm-hmm, like Tulip doesn't seem like the naggy girl, but she wants to hold her own and she wants to stand up. And they have this conversation back and forth where they're just like not listening to each other, you know, because she's just like, you don't think that I can take it. And he's like, you don't understand that I've seen you die once. I don't want to see that again. Yeah. Like, I know you can hold your own. I don't want you in a situation where an accident could happen.
Which is a conversation you often hear between men and women in movies and TV shows.
Yeah. And where it's usually adversarial. It is kind of here, but they also come to an understanding. Yeah. So it doesn't continue to be that... You know, I'm going to shoot you to the moon, Alice, kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Cassidy's definitely growing on me. He's one of my favorite characters.
He's my favorite.
Especially at the moment where Tulip is about to get shot and Cassidy claims to be Jesse to save her. Mm-hmm. And to think, that's a character moment for Cassidy. Yeah. We get a character moment, not just him ripping people's throats out when he gets into a fight.
One of the other things I love that he does is that he introduces a character that doesn't really ever have to have a backstory, and it's not going to last forever, but it's still kind of a great moment. So there's the guy who's torturing Cassidy, and he's the gangster who had his privates cut off.
He's like Frankie something.
Frankie Nunez or something like that. And he's just telling this story about, you know, how horrible this is. And it's just like this casual story to him. Yeah. And then he's just like, I got some aggression to work off. And then he starts torturing Cassidy. Yeah. And so you kind of get like just enough backstory to like, this is a person.
Yes.
And I appreciate that. And then, but you know, he doesn't make it out.
Yeah.
So there's always a bunch of characters like that. They're just like, there's no real reason for you to have done that.
That was a very Tarantino moment where you have this extensive dialogue that doesn't seem to go anywhere, is great character stuff, doesn't move the plot forward, but is incredibly compelling and you get caught up in it. But, you know, you want this guy to die because you watch him shoot Cassidy's body parts off over and over
with an elephant gun.
Yeah.
I think Garth Ennis does it way better than Tarantino does. I think Tarantino just goes on for a while.
But just for those folks who are not familiar with Preacher and probably are more familiar with Tarantino,
for sure.
Tarantino is gratuitous. You know,
well, it's just it seems more self-serving, while this actually seems like, I'm going to give this guy a story and then we're going to move on. And it just feels, it doesn't feel like it's wasting your time. It feels like time well spent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
And I always
what?
Na na na. Time well spent. What I've forgotten about and what I'm enjoying is watching also the progression of Jesse and Cassidy's relationship, you know, and we get to
their beautiful romance.
Well, you get to the point where you realize that this is the closest friend that Cassidy has had for 100 years or so, since the Irish Rebellion, when he tells his whole backstory and stuff like that. I forgot how poignant that was, and really helps to build the drama. And am I mistaken? He winds up going to Masada in Jesse's place, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He tells everybody except, I mean, does he tell Herr Starr that he's Jesse Custer? No, because Starr knows who Custer is.
No, that was what Ben had mentioned, Tulip's in that situation.
Right.
And he's taken to Masada under the pretense that he is Custer, and they only learn later on.
Right.
When, I can't remember who spills the beans, but, my car alarm's going off.
Oh dear.
Is that your car alarm?
No, I don't know.
Okay. It sounds like it's next door.
Yeah. Oh.
Somebody's robbing the pot store.
Hey, they were in there partying up the storm a couple minutes ago. Hear them carrying on.
There's one. The other thing, because I can just identify a few little tiny things that I was like iffy about, is I think speaks volumes because the majority of it was great. But I was very against the cat torture in the very beginning.
Oh, yeah. Don't even get me started.
But I do like the moment where Jesse tries to use the word of God on the cat and it doesn't work. And he's like, well, it must not speak American.
Yes, indeed.
You know, I forget there are people in the world that just have a genetic predisposition to hate cats.
Yeah.
You know, and Ennis is one of them. His hatred of cats comes up on a regular basis in his stories. Yeah.
This cat, to at least be fair, play devil's advocate, was a really mean cat.
Yeah.
And good on the girlfriend for putting something there, you know, putting a secret code or something along the collar. It is a literal guard cat to something, you know, like.
All right, before we wrap this up, do we have any final things we want to say about this volume of Preacher that we read?
I always liked Old Father Daronek.
Can we talk about the Masada stories next time?
Sure.
Because I think that, I mean, we touched on part of it, but yeah,
we're kind of floating in and out of three different stories.
The All Father story and bringing the Holy Child to Masada and that whole climax and the Saint of Killers.
I love the idea of this villain who is a caricature of a human, but at the same time is like utterly dangerous and intelligent,
right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So.
Holy Father. He basically is the Holy Father, a sent up of the Holy Father of the Catholic Church, because Masada has that type of power and influence apparently on the world as does the Catholic Church.
Yep.
Yeah. So. And whenever Cole writes about Jack Kirby in the panel jumper scripts, he always refers to them as the All Father. Mm-hmm. And whenever write All Father, I'm like Jack Kirby. All right.
Yeah.
It is I, Jack Kirby.
Yes.
All right. So that's Preacher. Maybe next time when we come back, we'll have a little bit more targeted detail of what we're going to talk about. All right. So
worked out okay.
Yeah. Exactly. I will always be happy to talk about that. Well, that is Book Report, and that is our show. Coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by the Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And now, friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. This time the questions come to us from me.
What?
All right, we talked about comics that haven't aged well, shows that have probably not aged well. A child of the 80s, I grew up with a TV as a babysitter and a Nintendo as a best friend. I have faint memories of watching various TV shows as a kid and liking them, and have yet to experience them as an adult. That being said, here are 5 questions about shows that I remember watching that I probably should stay away from today if I want to keep liking them. Number 1, Ralph Hinckley is a Los Angeles public school teacher Ralph Hinckley is a Los Angeles public school substitute teacher of special education high school students. During a school field trip, the group encounters aliens who give Hinckley a suit which endows him with superhuman abilities to fight crime and injustice in the world. Soon after, Hinckley loses the instruction manual to the suit and must discover the different powers it grants him through trial and error, often leading to hilarious results. Anybody?
Greatest American Hero.
It is indeed the Greatest American
Hero. Which I keep hearing rumors they're rebooting.
I've heard that too, but I don't think that's gone anywhere yet.
No.
They're rebooting every single TV show that ever.
Well, it's the time of the reboot.
Yeah. Number 2, the Marshall family, Rick, Will, and Holly, are brought to an alternate universe through a dimensional portal as they are swept down a 1,000-foot waterfall. They find themselves trapped in a world inhabited by dinosaurs, a primate-type people called Pakuni, and aggressive humanoid lizard creatures called Sleestak. Cole, I know you know this one.
The Land of the Lost!
Okay, yeah.
You left out the greatest earthquake ever known.
I forgot about that part. All right, number 3. In the future, an oligarchy of television networks rules the world. Edison Carter is a hard-hitting reporter for Network 23 who sometimes uncovers things that his superiors at the network would have preferred kept private. When he discovers a scandal and is injured trying to escape with the information, a hacker uploads his mind into a computer where he helps his fellow reporters follow up on the nefarious doings of Network 23.
Is that Max Headroom?
Max Headroom.
They actually re-released those on DVD a couple years ago. I watched them all. They are silly and they are dated, but they are actually worth watching.
I think dated is different than aging poorly. Okay. Dated is fun and dusty.
Yeah. I was surprised how fun they were to watch.
Okay. I will go back and watch Max Headroom.
Yeah.
Okay. Number 4, cousins Bo and Luke, two good old boys fighting the system, rip around the southern countryside in their souped up Dodge Charger, evading the bumbling sheriff Roscoe P. Coltrane and his superior boss hog. What is this TV show?
Dukes of Hazzard.
Dukes of Hazzard. Well,
do you know the answer? You just keep looking at me because I'm old.
I know. Well, I know the answer, but I can't think of the answer because I never watched a damn show.
Oh, and Nicole, how about you? What's your excuse?
I honestly forgot it because it's not in my brain and I've never watched
then
it.
Then why is it in my brain?
I just wanted to call them the Dodge Brothers.
Wow.
Them old Dodge boys.
Yeah.
All right. And finally, number five. Police detective Michael Arthur Long had a bad day on the job. Near death after a shot to the face, he's rescued by a self-made billionaire and given a new face, new name, and a new car. A heavily modified, technologically advanced Pontiac Firebird Trans Am. With this new identity and wheels, he becomes the primary field agent in the billionaire's public justice organization, the Foundation for Law and Government, or FLAG. What is this TV show that I should probably not watch?
I'm going to look at the older guy.
Knight Rider. It is Knight Rider.
Wait, he was shot in the face?
David Hasselhoff. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he was really unattractive before. Then he got shot in the face, and then he became the pretty, pretty, pretty David Hasselhoff.
What you learn is when you get shot in the face, you turn into David Hasselhoff.
There you go. That's
a right. man who doesn't exist. All right. Well, that is quiz time. And that is our show. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.